Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dr. Walter Dean for the show called Getting It Done. Today's show has four different parts to it. We're going to hear information about racist origins that black people have had to endure since black people first were brought here all the way up to the present time. After this first presentation is completed, we will go on to a woman who will discuss some other aspects of the past. So, without any further ado, let's begin.
Well, our intent is to maintain order and promote justice, and as members of society, we uphold them. But what happens when those laws promote and spread discrimination and bigotry? In this episode of Origin of Everything, we'll be analyzing the discriminatory history of U.S. law, tracing its origins in colonialism to the present-day penal system. In order to deconstruct this troubling history, we'll be looking at four distinct time periods of U.S. law. First, we'll look at the foundation of legal discrimination based on race during colonialism. Next, we'll examine the system of chattel slavery to see how the legacies of colonialism translated into ongoing legal subjugation for black subjects in the U.S. Third, we'll explore how Jim Crow laws extended legal discrimination into the 20th century. And finally, we'll discuss how the concepts of being tough on crime in the latter half of the 20th and early 21st century allowed the continuation and expansion of discriminatory laws under the umbrella of mass incarceration. By tracing this timeline, we'll be looking at the ways discriminatory legal practices have always disproportionately impacted black and brown communities and how these legacies and laws continue to have adverse effects on vulnerable communities to this day. But before we get into the heart of how laws and sentencing structures can be discriminatory, we should clarify a few key terms, namely crime and punishment. And no, I'm not talking about the Dostoevsky novel of the same name. I'm talking about crime or breaking of laws and punishment, as in the penalty you pay as a result of being found guilty of committing a crime. Although we often think of these things as directly correlated, think of the old adage, if you do the crime, you've got to do the time, there's actually not a direct relationship between how much crime is committed and what types of punishment are meted out. In his book, Thinking About Crime, Sense and Sensibility in American Penal Culture, Professor Michael Tonry notes that nations with remarkably similar crime rates often have vastly different sentencing and punishment standards. He determines that crime rates and punishment rates often don't align, and that governments decide how much punishment they want. He writes, this can be seen by comparing crime and punishment trends in Finland, Germany, and the United States between 1960 and 1990. The trends are close to identical. Violent crime rates in all three countries grew by a factor of 3 to 4, and homicide rates more than doubled. Yet the U.S. imprisonment rate quadrupled in that period, the Finnish rate fell by 60%, and the German rate was broadly stable. So in this example, we see three countries with almost identical crime trends with three starkly different ideas of punishment. Therefore, when we analyze how laws are broken and punishment is assigned, we have to look at why societies change their stances on crime and punishment. Tonry attributes this to a few factors, two important ones being moral panics and the sensibilities of a society. Moral panics, as he describes them, occur when a society sees a moral or social issue and overreacts as a result, which usually leads to increased rates of punishment or more severe punishment for offenders. Another cause is that societal sensibilities, or the attitudes and beliefs of the society, often change, which in turn changes the types of acts we consider crimes and the types of things we consider as just punishment. So although we're often taught to look at crime as directly correlated to punishment, there's actually an argument to be made that they're working somewhat independently of each other. Which brings us to our first stop in the history of legal discrimination in the United States, colonialism and slavery. After colonies were established in North America, colonists were subject to the laws and customs of England. In their essay, Situating Colonialism, Race, and Punishment, Professors Jeetha Chowdhury and Mark Beeman explained how the development of slavery in the North American colonies, and later in the early United States, became dependent on the passage of discriminatory laws that specifically targeted people of African descent. They detail how, although the concept of discrimination based on ethnic or social groups dates back to antiquity, the idea that race was entirely based on skin tone and physical features evolved alongside the emergence of chattel slavery. Then the idea was solidified with the emergence of scientific racism in the 18th and 19th centuries. Chowdhury and Beeman go on to note that although some of the original people of African descent who entered the English colonies came as indentured servants and were eventually set free, similar to English indentured servants, this quickly changed when colonists turned to chattel slavery as a source of consistent, exploited, and unpaid labor. They write, "In other words, slavery seems to have evolved in part as a punishment reserved for Africans originally indentured. English indentured servants, presumably protected by English rights and the Christianity they shared with their masters, avoided such punishment. From the 1640s to the 1660s, with the principle of lifelong involuntary servitude established for Africans in colonial America, individual colonies began enacting legislation declaring Negroes sent to the colonies and their offspring slaves for life. In short, slavery in British colonial America became a punishment for being black." With this important distinction, colonial America created the system of chattel slavery that sentenced black people to perpetual servitude. Slavery created an explicit relationship between race and the law from the earliest foundations of American society. And this new legal category meant that new forms of punishment and torture were invented to accommodate this shift and who could be considered a full person under the law. Soon laws and colonial codes were written to regulate the control and punishment of the enslaved. Although slavery was not the first instance of race being tied to laws in the new colonies, the colonization of land in North America was based on the assumption that Native Americans did not have rights through the land they had inhabited long before settler colonialism declared North America as uninhabited. Therefore, laws that allowed white settlers to displace and physically harm Native Americans also established an early relationship between race and the law in colonial America. While most punishment was left up to slave owners and could include torture, brutal beatings, rape, and other inhumane cruelties, more serious punishment, such as execution, was sometimes left up to the discretion of judges for supposed offenses that occurred away from the plantation. But whether it was being dealt by overseers and owners or by the state, the result was a system of exploitation and legally supported subjugation that left black subjects almost entirely outside of the protections of the law. This system remained firmly in place in parts of the United States until 1865, with the ratification of the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments. But even these newly won freedoms could not guarantee the continuation of legal and extra-legal methods of racial and social control. Following the close of the Civil War in 1865, the U.S. entered into a period known as Reconstruction, which lasted until the 1870s. Although there were some legal and societal victories for black subjects during this time, they were swiftly overturned and replaced by Jim Crow laws. Jim Crow introduced a set of laws that systematically stripped black citizens of their rights while also relegating them to inferior, separate but equal public facilities like schools, washrooms, and sections of the bus, among other indignities. Black citizens were denied access to basic rights like voting while also suffering under the weight of racial terror imposed by groups like the KKK and other white supremacists who organized lynchings and other forms of racialized violence. Jim Crow laws effectively relegated black subjects to second-class citizenship based on a racialized caste system where white citizens were privileged above all others. This system of disenfranchisement was also supported by methods of financial control like sharecropping, which effectively reinstated the financial inequity of slavery through unfair practices. And systems like convict leasing guaranteed that black people would be returned to a system almost identical to slavery in everything but name. With convict leasing, private businesses could rent the labor of prisoners to complete tasks. The businesses would pay the state, and the prisoners would be forced to perform labor for free. As a result, southern states started incarcerating newly emancipated black citizens at a higher rate, for anything from petty theft to vagrancy to other vaguely defined laws. This practice lasted from the late 19th century into the early 20th century. For more on the convict leasing system, check out our episode, "Why Do We Have Private Prisons?" right here on our channel. The story of Jim Crow finally came to an official end with the emergence of the modern civil rights movement of the 1950s and 1960s, when civil rights leaders and activists fought to have these decade-long practices rolled back. But that only led to new waves of racialized legal discrimination. In her book, The New Jim Crow, legal scholar, civil rights lawyer, and advocate Michelle Alexander details the relationship between race and continued legal discrimination in the form of mass incarceration. In the 1960s, the prison population in the United States was around 200,000, but by the early 2000s, that number had exploded to over 1.5 million people in prison, with hundreds of thousands in other penal facilities, think youth facilities, jails, and immigrant detention centers. And much of that increase can be attributed to Reagan-era war on drugs policies, although the war on drugs was first popularized by the Nixon administration in the 1970s. Popular wisdom connects these policies to the rise of crack cocaine across the U.S. However, according to Alexander, the official political campaign in 1982, known as the War on Drugs, actually predates the rise of crack cocaine addiction it was commonly assumed to address. She writes, "A few years after the drug war was declared, crack began to spread rapidly in the poor black neighborhoods of Los Angeles and later emerged in cities across the country. The Reagan administration hired staff to publicize the emergence of crack cocaine in 1985 as part of a strategic effort to build public and legislative support for the war. The media campaign was an extraordinary success. The media bonanza surrounding the new demon drug helped to catapult the war on drugs from an ambitious federal policy to an actual war. Because of its cheaper price, crack cocaine use spread more rapidly in poor communities than its more expensive counterpart, powder cocaine. After the war on drugs picked up popularity and speed, we began to see the rapid incarceration of minorities, oftentimes for nonviolent drug-based offenses as a result. And those arrested for crack cocaine-related charges faced much more severe sentences compared to other drug offenses. For example, it was common practice to follow the 100-to-1 rule. An op-ed in the New York Times explains, in what's known as the 100-to-1 rule, federal law mandates a 10-year sentence for anyone caught with 50 grams of crack, about the weight of a candy bar. To get a comparable sentence, a dealer selling powdered cocaine would have to be caught with 5,000 grams, enough to fill a briefcase. This wasn't rolled back until 2010 when Congress passed the Fair Sentencing Act. The act reduced the disparities between sentencing for crack and powder cocaine from 100-to-1 to 18-to-1. But despite the partial reversal of war on drugs policies, the U.S. still imprisons more people per capita and overall than any other country in the world. And although African Americans made up only roughly 13% of the U.S. population in the 2010 census, in many areas they are the majority of the prison population, even though they are not necessarily committing crime at a higher rate than white populations. As a result, Alexander writes, although this new system of racialized social control purports to be colorblind, it creates and maintains racial hierarchy much as earlier systems of control did. Like Jim Crow and slavery, mass incarceration operates as a tightly networked system of laws, policies, customs, and institutions that operate collectively to ensure the subordinate status of a group defined largely by race. In her book, she details the ways that those who are convicted of crimes are permanently labeled as felons and thus systematically barred from access to the full rights of citizenship through processes like employment discrimination, being denied the right to vote, and being excluded from jury duty, although some activist groups are fighting to reverse or lessen these discriminations. So this episode just scratches the surface of the ways that laws can be established to promote unequal life outcomes for different citizens based on race. We haven't even begun to cover other forms of legal and extra-legal discrimination that occur on the basis of gender, immigration status, sexuality, and class, not to mention other minority groups that have been exposed to increased policing, surveillance, and punishment as a result of legal discrimination. It also raises fundamental questions about the law, namely, who is it meant to protect and at whose expense are some of these policies enacted? My hope is that this serves as a productive primer to the ways that law can be manipulated to serve certain groups over others and will inspire us all to remain dedicated to recognizing and standing against injustice wherever it arises. This is just our first episode on this topic, so be sure to check out the second part right here on our channel. Hey, Original.
Well, I'm quite sure you got an opportunity to hear about how black people have been treated from the time they were brought here all the way up to the present time. It's just like we've been seeing things happen around the United States where some police persons are shooting black people or not shooting but holding their knees on their neck, and then you see them not receiving the same kind of law and treatment as black people who may have done something even less than that. Black people were punished from slavery all the way up to the present time and still are still being punished for something other than their, nothing more than their color. Slavery still occurs today when you consider the large number of African Americans who are incarcerated. You can consider the prison system in favor of maintaining and allowing slavery to continue to occur. I had promised that I was going to go on to another section and deal with someone else. And so that's what we're going to do. We're going to take a look at the next one. And this was called A Genealogist Who Tracks Down Modern Day Slavery Practices. Let's give a listen.
My dad, that I always family, was here this day. He did come get you or have somebody kill you, whatever. Gary Dawson, he lived there in the same place he lived there. He left, they went and got him, brought him back, carried him down there from his house, killed him, hung him up in a tree, and cast him around him, and hung him up, back from his house for his children, everybody could see him. I'm pretty sure it was 55, 56, when this happened.
Most of us think that the end of the Civil War in 1865 closed the chapter on slavery in the American South. But that's far from the truth. Over the next 100 years, generations of Black Southerners were forced to labor against their will. This new form of slavery happened in the shadows of the first half of the 20th century. And even though civil rights movement began advancing racial equality in the South in the 1950s, these practices continued secretly, making it a difficult history to prove. Today, there's one woman who's dedicated her life to finding this lost history of Black identity. She's been called the Slavery Detective of the South.
We're currently in Louisiana, about to meet Antoinette Harrell, who specializes in finding cases of essentially modern-day slavery. We're really deep in the South right now. It's super swampy and super rural. I was actually born in Boston and moved to Atlanta, Georgia, like early on in my childhood, but I've never been out this far deep into Louisiana. I'm very interested in connecting with Antoinette and learning more about her work.
Hi.
Hello, Antoinette.
Hi.
Nice to meet you.
Antoinette was born and raised in Louisiana, and even though she lost her leg to cancer a few years ago, that hasn't slowed her down from what she sees as a mission of justice, tracking down and verifying cases of slavery and abusive labor practices that happened after the Civil War. Sometimes she gets leads from newspaper clippings, old FBI reports, or recorded testimonies, and sometimes she just gets a phone call.
I got scared because I seen how they beat some of the boys. They beat people to death in there.
Mike, I appreciate you not taking this story to the grave with you. I know it hurt. I know it's very painful. And the state of Florida can't pay you all enough. But I'll be in touch with you shortly.
A few of Antoinette's investigations have been used in court cases for reparations, though sometimes the end goal is simply to give people knowledge of their family roots, which for a lot of Black Southerners is something that slavery erased.
Let me first tell you how I got started with this. Researching my own family history. My family was held as slaves. Well, in 1863, my family was emancipated. And my family did become sharecroppers. Robert Harrell became a sharecropper under the system of sharecropping. The planter and the newly freed former slaves came into an agreement. I will furnish you with the seeds, with the land, a place to stay. In return, you will give me a portion of the crops. Well, not everyone did the right thing.
Although sharecropping was technically legal, the practice was widely abused by white landowners who used debts to keep African Americans tied to the land that they once worked as slaves. Sharecroppers didn't pay rent, but they didn't own any property. And today, historians agree sharecropping was just slavery by a different name.
So many former enslaved Africans had nothing. They had no choice. At the end of the year, you owe me. No matter how hard you work, you were told, sorry.
And those cases relate directly to your cases today.
Right. After slavery, these are like 1921, 1930, 1940s, the 50s, and some of them to the 60s.
I'm asking you to make a donation right now to have your gift triple match and help us flip the Senate and ditch Mitch. Antoinette's very first case was May Louise Miller, a woman who was held as a slave with her entire family in Mississippi until 1961. Though May passed away in 2014, Antoinette took us to see one of her brothers, Arthur Miller.
May and Arthur being two of the older sisters and brothers, they remember a lot. It took a long time before Arthur really opened up and talked.
We lived on, I don't know what would you call it, but something like a plantation. Because they belonged to several different white people. They all were family, I guess. And you couldn't leave. If you did leave, they either come get you or have somebody kill you or whatever. That's what happened. They gave my mom a bed.
What they did to your mother?
They just had my mother, you know, the white man. They just do what they want to do with her. And I just wasn't big enough to do that. If I would have been, I don't know. Probably would be.
And this was in the 1950s or 40s?
That was only through the 40s, in the 50s, all through the 50s, and part of the 60s.
So what would the repercussions be if you tried to leave or if you tried to refuse what they wanted?
Back in them days, it was kind of like you had to do what the white man said or get killed. And then his uncle, he didn't even dig his grave, they killed him. They killed him, buried his own grave. Jared Dawson, they killed him. He lived on the same place he lived on. He left and said he wasn't coming back. They went and got him, brought him back, carried him right down there from his house, killed him. Hung him up in a tree.
They hung him.
They killed him first, castorized him, and hung him up right from his house so he was shooting everybody could see him.
Were you aware that this is 1940s, 1950s, that Arthur, this breaks my heart to hear this story. Growing up, were you fully aware, this is in the 40s and 50s, you know, the civil rights movement is just about to begin. Were you aware of what was going on in the rest of the country at that time for black people pursuing freedom?
No.
You weren't aware at all that there was any pursuit for freedom in the 40s and 50s for us?
No, not really. Not really at all. I think maybe like in 65, 66, and he was born at Margie. You know, that's when I really found out. People are scared to talk about it. If people right now, y'all go to talk to you, they won't talk with y'all about this.
Mm-hmm.
They're scared to do it. They got their fear in them all. Huh?
How could something like this happen?
A lot of these places that was in very isolated rural areas, it was easy. I mean, you had the opportunity to ride through some of these areas and you saw for miles and miles, there's absolutely nothing.
You think, like, how can somebody not just escape these type of conditions? And once you actually are out here, you see there is nothing but cotton fields and crops and long strips of road. Where can you fathomably go? It's insane to see how you can be trapped on this land on so many different levels, whether it be economically, physically, and even mentally.
We're calling on the world in terms of righteousness, reparation.
Antoinette's work for Arthur's family got the attention of a lawyer in 2001, and they became part of a class action lawsuit for reparations. But ultimately, the Supreme Court refused to hear the case, and the pursuit for reparations has since been dropped.
How you doing, ma'am? My name is Antoinette Harrell, and I'm a historian. Hey, how y'all doing? I got a question. Can I ask you something right quick? The lady in the next block told me there used to be a store where people used to share crop or work on somebody's land. Do anybody know that story?
Is that how you do a lot of your work, just going out and talking to the community?
Hey, how you doing? A kid come with me.
Yeah.
Did you ever pick cotton?
Oh, yeah. It takes me a whole day to get to
One of Antoinette's new cases took us to the Ball Ground Plantation to meet a man named Donald Jeffrey. Donald comes from five generations of sharecroppers who worked the same land under the Simrow family. Donald still lives here, along with the last descendant of the Simrow family, a man named Karsten. Today, Donald works full-time on another farm, but still lives rent-free on this plantation and does odd jobs for Karsten. So their living situation is unconventional, to say the least.
Why is Donald so nervous? Like, we're pretty conspicuous right now.
Because I don't think he wants the boss man to see us here. Hey, Donald.
Hey there, Donald. Nice to meet you.
Hey, good to see you.
My mama's dad is, when they come along in their time, they will share problems.
What kind of work was done on this plantation?
Everything, food with cows, horses, and farming.
What kind of work did your mother do on the plantation?
She mostly did make or did cooking. She told me at 14 years old, she started chopping cotton, and she would leave out the cotton field at a quarter, 20 minutes, 11, and cook a dinner to have it ready at 12.
Why did you not leave the plantation?
Because it was home. And I loved it. It was a beautiful place. And I just didn't leave. You know, you're responsible for your light bill, but you don't pay no water bill or no rent. So, I mean, that's all. It works out.
So what is your relationship to this plantation?
Born and raised here. And Karsten, he's almost like a brother to me. I mean, we have a real close relationship, a bond.
So there's a brotherhood between you and Karsten.
Mm-hmm.
Like family.
Yeah, we are. Okay. We like family, sure. Like brother, I can go right there now, spend the night in the house.
All the people that work on this plantation, he refused to put them off. He would let them stay here.
Yeah.
And that's how you end up staying.
That's right.
Do I feel like he's holding back some things? Yes, I do. But he lives here, and he has to stay here when I'm gone. And I don't want to put anybody's life in jeopardy, you know, because this can happen. I mean, you know, if you're talking about things that people don't want to be told, there's always someone that don't want you to talk about something.
That night, I spoke with Karsten about his family's history on the plantations.
Is that Karsten?
Hey there, what y'all got going on?
How's it going, man? Akil.
Hey
nice
there.
To meet you.
What
nice
you
to meet you.
Oh,
thanks for letting us, showing us around.
Yeah, man. Good to see you.
Yeah, good to see you.
All
right, great.
Y'all want anything to eat or anything? Y'all want any beer?
Coca-Cola? It's fine. Oh, it's fine. If we could just do a little tour, that'd be amazing.
Okay.
Just kind of talk a little bit about the history of Ball Ground Plantation.
This is my wife, Natalie.
Nice to meet you. And then I would say the Simrow family goes a long way out here, right?
Yes. My family bought this place in 1899. So I'm the fifth generation.
What is your relationship with Donald?
I don't even remember meeting him. Honest to God, we were childhood friends. No joke. I promise to God.
Are you related to this man right here?
Yes. That is my great-great-great-grandfather.
What time period is this?
Ooh, that would probably be in the 30s.
This man right here was related to Donald, correct?
That's Eli.
Well, what kind of work was he doing at that time? Was he just like a general helper for your great-grandfather?
Just anything. He just do anything. And if anybody fooled with him, they had a hell to pay.
Is he still with
just
us?
Like nobody fooled with Donald. Truth, they know how.
Can you talk a little bit about the history of the land as well?
Back then, it was very little open land, okay? Because every home had their own little allotment, okay? Like, say that you were living on my farm, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Rent-free, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Seriously. Honest to God. I mean, who wouldn't do that?
Mm-hmm.
Shit. I mean, everybody else was charging their people.
Right, so they just worked the crops and didn't have to pay rent on this land.
Never, ever.
Now, just because Donald was explaining a little bit about his
mm-hmm.
his history, his experience.
Sometimes
growing up,
Donald's
yeah.
full of shit.
Oh, yeah?
And you don't have to edit that either.
So I see that there's some Confederate dollars here. Did your family have a lot of ties to the Confederate Army?
Not really.
Just had the currency.
What misconceptions are there, do you feel, about the Confederate Army?
Here it is, right here. You can read it.
The Southern Nation, the rise of the Old South.
He says the South was right. It was written by two Kennedy brothers.
This is about the South being right during the Civil War.
I'm not trying to push the book, but it's proven. I mean, you can talk to anyone.
We're in Vicksburg, Mississippi right now at the county courthouse where we're going to be looking at documents of Ball Ground Plantation where we met Donald and Carson yesterday. Antoinette wanted to see if she could find any information on Donald's family before they were sharecroppers for the Seminoles. Since most African Americans have no information about their lineage from this time, it can be an important first step in grasping that part of our identity. We started with his last name, Jeffrey. So Antoinette is tracing the lineage of Donald, who has the last name Jeffrey, because his former slave masters had the name Jeffrey. Just like, my name is Gibbons, formerly the slaveholder that owned my family.
Yeah.
Oh, Jeffrey's.
Mm-hmm. This is the estate. This is the personal property that he owns. So we want to hope that we find someone names in here. Okay, I need you to pull file 1101. Okay, come on, baby. You got to be. Somebody talk to me.
Finding records like this is rare when you think about how black families were systematically separated, sold off, and then trafficked across state lines. Even finding one person related to Donald would be a long shot.
I can't say that this is Donald's family, but there was one Negro woman and children for $850. Look at it for yourself. Oh, we have some names. John, $660. George, $650. Why is this important to me? Because when I'm doing Donald's genealogy, I will look for these names and see if his genealogy can connect me to one of these people. They had five mules, a plow, a sofa. In order to find anyone's family who was held as slaves, they have to look into the property inventory. So this can be very painful for people of African descent to do this. I'm looking at the expression on your face right now. You know.
Yes.
Is this the first time you have seen a document like this?
Yeah, but, you know, you understand the realities of our history.
Mm-hmm.
But to see it on a receipt listed, you know, from 1840s, I've never seen before.
Yeah.
Now that we had the names, Antoinette called another genealogist to run them through the National Archives.
Jeffrey.
Got to look at all of them.
Jeffrey. Sorry.
We went through marriage licenses and found another relation named Bell Edwards.
Here's the I can order that file.
Bell Edwards. Okay, Bernice, I'm going to take a picture of something and send it to you right quick.
Okay.
We're trying to give Donald some of his history as a gift. There you go. I just sent you something.
So, Antoinette, can you tell us what you just found?
I just found Edward Griffin. And Bell Edwards was married in 1877. So this is Donald's ancestor. She might have filed something. Hold on. Hello, Bernice. Where'd you find?
Isabella Edwards. They have the whole tree, plus they have pictures and everything.
Oh, I'm about to pass out. Tell them.
Oh, my goodness. Here it is, the Jeffrey tree.
Let me sit
down. That's crazy.
Here I am. Looking at pictures.
Wow, this is amazing.
89 people. Earl May Jeffrey, Maggie B. Jeffrey Reed, Hawkins. They even have the cemetery.
Oh my God. I'm in tears. I mean, I'm really actually in tears.
I cannot believe this. Donald only knew.
Antoinette was able to identify an entirely new branch of Donald's family. She found that his ancestors could be traced back to Virginia, one of the first and largest slave ports in America. It's now up to Donald to determine what he wants to do with this knowledge. It's hard to know how to accept any of our history in America, but at the very least, Even learning who our ancestors from this time were feels like an act of justice. How do you feel about the work? You know, Antoinette's visiting different places.
That's a good match. Now, listen, you know, y'all too, it's good what y'all doing. That's real good. It's good for somebody to know how people have been treated.
After the Civil War, we were, as African Americans, promised 40 acres and a mule to begin to have our own lives as Americans, but we weren't able to get it. You think that if we were given reparations, that we may be able to fix what has been wrong?
It may not really fix it, but it would help. You know what I'm saying? It's just something that's kind of unfixable. You can kind of amend it back together a little bit, but you completely fix certain things. Killing Malcolm, you know, make him be screamed, you know, just stuff like that. You just can't fix that there by yin and yang.
That's an entire piece of history that will be lost. We need to do as much recording with people who would talk about it. A lot of people went through it, but they're afraid to talk about it. It's bittersweet. It's bittersweet. The more you learn, the more I dig, the more I find. Sometimes things are a little hard to digest. So I just do it because it needs to be done.
Well, I'm quite sure you are amazed as much as I am. So today, so many believe that slavery came to an end in 1863. However, it did not. There were slaves all the way up to 1961. The name slavery may have changed today, but based on what was stated, it was changed into sharecroppers. It was changed into Jim Crowism and the way people were treated within the context of those particular systems. In fact, in the year 2008, a case was brought to the Supreme Court that about slavery back in Alabama. Can you believe that the Supreme Court did not want to hear the case? And that's almost 100 years ago as to what took place. This has been Dr. Dean, Walter Dean, speaking. And we got two more sessions to go before we get to the time for us to get out of this program. In any event, we're going to be checking out something about a museum. I don't think many of you understand that there was a museum that was developed that deals with slavery. And it's like called the Whitney Plantation Museum Confronts Painful History of Slavery. Let's give a listen.
The museum in America dedicated entirely to slavery opened just a few months ago. Michelle Miller traveled to Wallace, Louisiana, and found a surprising history, not just about a plantation, but her own family. Michelle, good morning.
Good morning. Well, about an hour's drive from New Orleans along the Mississippi River sits the Civil War-era sugarcane plantation. The Whitney Plantation looms as a stark reminder that our nation was built on the backs of slaves. It's a tough part of our history to remember, but one man is investing a fortune to bring it all back to life.
This house is full of secrets.
They would sleep on pallets on the floor.
Beneath whitewashed ceilings, through quiet gardens, a dark history unfolds. Tourists peer into cages where slaves were beaten. Statues of black children stare back at them. In this sanctuary, memorializing the harsh reality of slavery, one figure seems out of place.
Good to see you.
The 77-year-old John Cummings.
Most people operate on ready, aim, fire, and I always operate on ready, fire, and an aim.
16 years ago, the New Orleans native and millionaire trial lawyer jumped at the chance to buy this 250-acre plantation without really knowing what he was getting into.
What didn't you know?
I got to a slave farm, and I saw some of the inventories from successions, and I was looking, man, 40 people just traded like cattle. And so then I discovered the oral histories, and that's when the light went on.
I got something here.
Well, I've got a great injustice here.
Cummings decided to dedicate the entire plantation to the slave perspective. He spent $8 million of his own money collecting antiques and commissioning art. The vacant Whitney started coming back to life.
I tell people when they say, well, why is a white man involved in this? I'll say, well, don't you remember it was a white man who caused all of this?
Here we honor the memory of 107,000 people.
To give it a voice, Cummings hired Senegalese historian Dr. Ibrahim Seck.
It is just amazing how these people...
Seck called diaries and inventories from auction and estate sales. He found more than 100,000 names of slaves traded and sold through the Louisiana Territory. Each name is etched into these walls.
There is no order. Just like it was total confusion, that just like the lives of the slaves. So you have African names, French names, Spanish names.
Next to those names are the narratives of the slaves themselves.
Doesn't mean much, but we make them talk. It's just a way for us to give them a voice, because these people were voiceless people.
One of the voiceless, the powerless, was a slave girl named Anna who had a child named Victor. Victor was born a slave, but the records show he is the son of her white slave owner's brother. Victor's great-granddaughter is 82-year-old Sybil Morial.
We didn't talk about it. Were they trying to save you?
I don't know if it was shame, or maybe if they were trying to save us. They didn't want to inflict that sad story on us. But it just sort of affirmed that my slavery ancestry was real, and it was only three generations ago.
Morial only recently learned of her direct lineage, of her connection to the Whitney, and of Victor's legacy beyond slavery.
He bought land and farmed it. So he overcame that life. And then the next generation did better, and the next generation did better. And then it's my generation, educated, successful.
Morial was a civil rights worker, a college vice president, and the first black first lady of New Orleans. But I already knew that. I married her son, Mark.
But how did you feel after you brought all of us together here?
I felt that I had given you my family, the ancestry, in color.
So my children now know.
They now know.
They're great.
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 Great. Grandmother.
Knowing can be freeing, but most often here, it is painful. One of the last sights are these sculpted heads, replicas of 60 men beheaded for their role in a local slave revolt more than 200 years ago. But Cummings wants people to realize we aren't that far removed.
You look at the paper and you'll see that some militant group has decapitated a French journalist. We all wonder what kind of barbarians could do that. We did that. Americans, we did that. Americans with white skin, we did that.
Do you feel guilty?
No. Only if I don't do what I'm doing right now. Over half of the people who come in here cry. And I cry.
You still cry.
I do. And proud of it. It affects me. The injustice is there. You really can't do anything about it to change it. But maybe you can change some of the effects of it. And that's what I think I'm doing.
Just accepting that history can do that?
Owning it.
Perhaps John's most important point is that we, even today, are still living with the effects of slavery, poverty, illiteracy, and crime. And he's on a campaign to not only provide a quality education in his state, in Louisiana, but he thinks it's really important that everyone who can go to college and who can't afford it gets to go for free.
What a story.
Yeah.
Oh, my
God. This morning I ask myself, when I look at that story and I look at the first story we saw today, and I ask you to get our connection.
That's a question we all have to ask ourselves, each and every one of us, because then it opens us to the possibility of, you know, what our beliefs are, certainly what our biases are. And I think it's a question that needs to be asked. I mean,
giving voice to the voices. And Michelle spending $8 million of his own money really shows a commitment.
Yeah.
It's very touched by him.
Yeah.
And you have your new mother-in-law.
Wow. Love her. I do. I love that woman. She's amazing.
She feels the same about me.
Thank you so much.
Thank
you.
Well, here we get. We come in contact with something that many may not have known. There is a museum, slavery museum, that's been in place now for pretty close to 10 years. And in this one right now, so the particular museum has been put there to show the injustices, the problems that most black people that lived in that area at that time had to experience as slave, as being part of the trading process, like the gentleman said, like cattle. We have one more presentation, and it's a little different because, you see, I've often wondered why black people are treated so poorly in this country. Maybe this particular presentation will give you an understanding of why. It's called The First White Man Was Black.
I know thy works and tribulation and poverty, but thou art rich. Welcome to The Black Excellence and Abundance Channel. Black people are the original inhabitants of the earth. Studies and findings show that the first humans were birthed in Africa, and then from the black humans, other races of the world were formed or mutated. For thousands of years, the world had only black people. The birth of white Europeans, Asians, Arabs, and other variants of light-skinned people was around 7,700 years ago. Cheddar Man is a human male fossil found in Goth's Cage in Cheddar Goth, Somerset, England. Excavated in 1903, Cheddar Man is Britain's oldest complete human skeleton. The remains are kept by the Natural History Museum in London in the New Human Evolution Gallery. Ladies and gentlemen, this is the face of the oldest complete human skeleton found in Europe. He is clearly a black man. Analysis of his nuclear DNA indicates that he was a typical member of the Western European population at the time, probably with lactose intolerance, light eyes, most likely green, but could be blue or hazel, dark brown or black hair, and dark or dark to black skin. However, a subsequent new scientists announced some skepticism from within the scientific community, including geneticists who worked on the findings. The genetic test identified some of the Cheddar Man's direct descendants among the locals of Cheddar and Somerset. Cheddar Man's remains had been unearthed 115 years ago in Goff's Cave, located in Somerset's Cheddar Gorge. Subsequent examination has shown that the man was short by today's standards, about 5 feet 5 inches, and probably died in his early 20s. Professor Chris Stringer, the museum's research leader in human origin, said, "I've been studying the skeleton of Cheddar Man for about 40 years. So to come face to face with what this guy could have looked like, and that striking combination of the hair, the face, the eye color, and that dark skin, something a few years ago we couldn't have imagined. And yet that's what the scientific data shows." Genetic studies by the University of Harvard in 2015 went a long way in proving that white people came from blacks. They came to this scientific conclusion by focusing on ancient Europeans' modern human fossils and remains. When the black humans reached the north of Europe, they met an icy and cold climate, which was different from their original habitat. During that era in human history, even Switzerland was immersed in ice. The Ice Age, which is known as Warm Glaciation, had begun around 130,000 years ago and ended about 10,000 years ago. There was less sunny days and colder, making the production of much vitamin D less likely, including the fact that the melanin was still active on the few sunny days. The initial deficiency in vitamin D, which was a result of melanin protection and low sunlight, caused disabilities, fractures, and also premature deaths among the first Africans in Northern Europe, the first people to arrive in Europe. Extensive research shows that white people had a higher vitamin D production than black people when exposed to the same dosage of sunlight. This was why the body of the first Africans in Northern Europe had to get rid of the melanin. Black people populated the whole of Luxembourg, Hungary, and Spain at around 8,500 years ago. The original Eurasians, who were the first Africans to arrive in Europe 7,800 years ago from Western Asia, spread two genes in Europe. The genes are SLC24A5 and SLC45A2, which are responsible for the skin color of the white man. The initial population of the Scandinavian region started around 7,700 years ago and was colder than in other regions of Europe. The initial white-skinned humans in Scandinavia carried the HERC2/OCA2 gene that is characterized by blue eyes, blonde hair, and white skin. The process is what science calls natural selection, and it led to the complete whitening of Europe around 5,800 years ago. Studies show that the three above-mentioned genes are albinism genes and are found in and originated from Africa. The OCA gene simply stands for oculocutaneous albinism and further shows that nature chose to uphold and spread albinism in Europe as a result of environmental constraints. And this then means that albinism, which is the state of the white man's skin, is originally an African trait. As was stated, the albinism in Europe is strongly related to blonde hair color, as it is in Africa. Also, there are traces of people with red hair in Africa who are not products of race mixing, as is the case with Africans with freckles. So European hair diversity is not originally a European phenomenon, but African. This diversity of hair color is a function of the original genes from Africa, which later showed up in the European white population. This phenomenon can be used to give an account of the green and blue eyes of Europeans. These eye colors are originally African as well and have spread among the white Europeans through the OCA2 gene. We literally come in all sizes, shapes, and colors. Straight hair among blacks and whites are more of a function of the climate than of genes. The heavy sunshine in Africa made the Africans grow spirally shaped hair to protect the head from excessive heat, while the cold temperature of Europe made the European hair to go down and cover the external respiratory organs from cold and diseases. But the facts remain that there are black people all over the world with straight hair. The Greeks in the description of the black people of ancient Sudan made mention of people with long and straight hair. Today, they are found in Europe and also in Africa among the Fulani people. So it is obvious that the straight hair was formed due to weather conditions during the time of their mutation. Here we have a picture on the period, which is located in the so-called Middle East. And on the right, we have a picture of the Jurong, who live in southern India, who is said to have migrated from Africa over 1,000 years ago. Many of us don't know, but the original Asians were also black. The modern-day Asians are usually cast as people, yet they are white. They are also a variant of the original African people. The present-day Eastern Asians possess the OCA2 gene, which also places them as albinos. But the original Asians were black. The Innu people were Japan's first inhabitants. And as you can see, they all are black. The slanted eyes, which are a characteristic of the Asians today, is the result of their living in the stormy mountains of North Asia, found between Siberia and Mongolia. Due to the high altitude, bright light and cold winds cause them to bend their eyes. These two factors, which were dominant in that region, were the reason their eyes turned that way. The Asian facial feature is found predominantly among the Chaucasian people of Africa, who are descendants of the Bantus and the Pygmies of the Great Lakes. The Arabs of today were produced from a mixture of whites and original blacks from Arabia, which are known as Sabians. About 100,000 years ago, Africans began their migration and journey outside the Black Continent and entered Yemen and what is known as Palestine today. They were the first modern humans to occupy entire Asia, moving from Israel to Japan. While they dominated Asia, other Africans traveled with the ocean currents through the Atlantic Ocean and arrived in what is now known as Brazil around 50,000 to 65,000 years ago. This migration resulted in the population of the Americas. So yes, folks, the first Americans were black. Many years ago, the study of the DNA of the living humans helped establish that we all share a family tree and a primordial migration story. All people outside Africa are descended from ancestors who left that continent more than 60,000 years ago. About 45,000 years ago, those first modern humans ventured into Europe, having made their way through the Middle East.
Well, I'm quite sure you've had an opportunity to see that the reason why, or possibly the reason why, we've been treated so poorly, maybe it's because white people don't want to accept the fact that they came from black people. That seems to be the case, or they're just too ignorant to accept the facts as has been expressed today. You have been listening to Getting It Done, and I have been your host, Dr. Walter Dean. Hopefully you enjoyed the show. You can contact me at docdean1212@gmail.com to let me know about your concerns. Until then, hopefully we'll hear from you, and you will be available to listen to the show on Monday. God bless.